All right, we are 1 Corinthians chapter 16. I'm just going to, as I studied this chapter, it ended up being richer than I was expecting, so I don't think I'm going to get past the first four verses today. I had initially thought I would get through the first nine. So let me just read the first four verses, and please follow along in your Bibles. Now, concerning the collection for the saints, y'all should do just as I ordered the churches of Galatia. On the first day of the week, each one of you should continue to deposit next to himself, saving up some of whatever, if any, he is being prospered, in order that, whenever I come, a collection will not happen then. And whenever I do arrive, whomever you shall approve, I will send them, along with letters, and carry your gift into Jerusalem. And if it happens to be hefty enough for me to go also, they'll go with me. All right, as we look back over the book of 1 Corinthians, it's clear that Paul's responding not only to a report that he got from the household of Chloe that there was disunity in the church in Corinth, but he also is answering some questions that the people in Corinth had sent to him in a letter. Chapter 7 opens with, "Now concerning the things you wrote about," and it goes on to answer some questions related to marriage and divorce and singleness. Then chapter 8 opened with, "Now concerning things sacrificed to idols," and he goes into this whole principle of not offending a weaker brother. And then chapter 12, "Now concerning spiritual gifts," and he launches into an explanation of the spiritual gifts and the supremacy of love. Finally, we have in chapter 16, verse 1, "Now concerning the collection for the saints," starting a new subject. Now, I don't know if Paul is the one bringing it up here or if it was a question from the Corinthian church. The context of this starts back when Paul returned to Jerusalem as a new Christian, and he met with the apostles there. In Galatians chapter 2, he describes his meeting and where he laid out his calling, what he believed his calling was, and explained the gospel that he was going to preach. And he told James, Peter, and John, "I believe, you know, this is the gospel as I understand it, and I believe it's God's calling for me to preach this to the Gentiles." He ran it by them, and they thought this was great, and they had only one exhortation for him. What do you suppose that one exhortation was? Was it, be sure that you keep following Reformed theology, or be sure that you do the Lord's Supper in just the right way? No. They had one word of advice: remember the poor. That was the only thing that they were concerned that Paul get. Remember the poor. So Paul made collections for the poor an integral part of his ministry, all throughout his ministry. He was one of the couriers who brought financial aid to Jerusalem from the church in Antioch. That's described in Acts 11. And if we piece together the bits of information from the books of Acts and Romans and 1 and 2 Corinthians, it appears that even on his first initial missionary contacts in these different cities throughout Asia Minor, could one of you guys, Josh, would you mind getting the map from upstairs and just bringing it and setting it up here? That might help us to get a little bit of map information. Anyway, as Paul went through his missionary journeys in Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey, and in Macedonia and Achaia, modern-day Greece, wherever he went and planted a church, he apparently also told them, "Now, what I'd like you to do is send some money back to Jerusalem." Even the first trip through, as he planted these churches. Apparently, when he came into Corinth, then he told them this, and they were apparently a wealthy church. Corinth was a wealthy international trade city. And apparently they said, yeah, okay, well, we'll give X amount of money or something like that. And Paul got excited about that. And then in his next trip up through some of the cities north of Corinth, he told the Thessalonica and Thessalonica, I mean Berea, Philippi, he told them, hey, the Corinthians down there have pledged to give this fabulous sum of money. How about you also give, you know, see if you can match that. Then what happened? Those churches in Macedonia were not as well off financially. In 2 Corinthians 8, we see a lot, 8 and 9, we see a lot more information about this whole situation. I'm going to be referring to 2 Corinthians 8 and 9 a lot in this morning. Where Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians 8, 1, we want to make known to you the grace of God in the churches of Macedonia, that in their great poverty they abounded in the wealth of their generosity. And then he explains how he had motivated them in 2 Corinthians 9, verse 2, I boasted about you, Corinthians, to the Macedonians, and your zeal stirred up a whole lot of them.
We have a Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey, and you've got modern-day Greece here, which Macedonia would have been the upper part, and Achaia would have been the lower part. And in Macedonia, you've got Philippi, Berea, and Thessalonica, and down here in Achaia, you've got Athens and Corinth.
Then what? So he got a good collection up in here, and it seems that some enthusiasm has cooled off in Corinth. The gift hadn't come yet. And so Paul bringing the subject back up here in 1 Corinthians 16, he'll do it again in 2 Corinthians. And it's kind of funny how Paul's playing these Gentile churches off of each other in competition. Hey, you Macedonians, the Corinthians gave this big gift. How about show them up? And then with the Corinthians, hey, you ought to do it like they're doing it in Galatia. Galatia is up in here, near Pisidian, Antioch, Iconium, Lystra, Derbe. Those were some of the very first churches that Paul planted. And then he goes back to Corinth. Hey, the Macedonians have given this great gift, and I told them you're going to give a big gift too, so don't embarrass me. He actually wrote that in 2 Corinthians 9. Be prepared, lest anybody from Macedonia comes with me, and we find you unprepared to give as generously as you pledged. And we, not to mention you, might be embarrassed. That's from 2 Corinthians 9, verses 3 and 4. So anyway, Paul eventually arrived in Corinth, and during the 3 months there in Corinth, he picked up the collection. He also wrote the book of Romans, going on to the Roman church, preceding a later visit that he would make there. And he wrote in the book of Romans, I'm going up to Jerusalem to minister to the saints, to take this collection that he had gathered in Corinth and take it back to Jerusalem. For it has been the good pleasure of Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution for the poor among the saints that are at Jerusalem. So I want to look at several aspects of this gift. We'll look at who it was for, how it was to be organized, when it was to be given, who was supposed to be doing the giving, how much was to be given, how it should be administrated. It's amazing how rich these four verses are with information. I guess also pulling information in from other books of the Bible that fill in details. It's amazing how much we can learn about giving from this little passage of Scripture. So who is it for? 1 Corinthians 6, verse 16, verse 1 uses the word saints. It was going to be for the saints. And then verse 3 mentions it was the saints in Jerusalem. These saints were not some special class of Christians. Paul used the same word, saints, to address the Corinthian church back in chapter 1, verse 2. It's just anyone who's been made holy to God by believing in His Son Jesus. What was the need there in Jerusalem? Scripture is not explicit at this point, but we can draw some inferences. There was persecution of believers in Jerusalem. The early chapters of Acts describe that persecution. This is sometime afterwards, but it definitely was there. And so our Christians had obviously lost land, they had lost jobs, they had lost money due to persecution and discrimination against Christians in Jerusalem. And so there were probably Christians that had been impoverished through persecution. It's a beautiful fruit of grace that Paul, who had been the chief agent of persecuting those Christians in Jerusalem, was now mobilizing funds to relieve those same Christians in Jerusalem. Other things going on in Jerusalem. There was at least one famine around this time in history. I read about one that was in AD 46. Food may have been very expensive and hard to get. And the poorer you are, the harder it is to get expensive food. Outside relief would have been a welcome refreshment to the Christians in Jerusalem. I also found it interesting that about half of the commentators I read attributed the financial distress of the Christians in Jerusalem to their practice of communism. In Acts chapter 2, verse 44 and 45, it talks about how they shared all things in common. And if you look throughout history, you see that societies that do that end up losing the motivation to work, and their national economies end up bankrupt. Whether or not that was the issue, I know that the love of God can make a huge difference and making that kind of thing work. I believe that families are to be communistic, not governments. But whether or not that was an issue, persecution and famine are certainly factors. And then on top of that, Paul encouraged the Gentile churches to do this in order to show gratitude to and solidarity with the believers from whom the gospel had come. These Jews had become Christians and were traveling throughout the world to share the gospel with Gentiles. Paul said, you know, you have every right to send money back and show your appreciation and gratitude for what they're doing, giving of themselves to share the gospel with you. Giving to the poor has always been part of God's call to His people. In the Old Testament, Solomon wrote, "He who has pity upon the poor lends to Jehovah, and he, God, Jehovah, will repay his good deeds." When we give to the poor, it is as though we've given to God. Jesus brought that up later on. Whatever you've done to the least of these, you've done unto me. He also said in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 6, verses 19 and following, Jesus said, "Do not lay up for yourself treasures upon the earth, where moth and rust consume and thieves break through and steal, but lay up for yourself treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust consume, and thieves do not break through or steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Where is your treasure? Where is your heart? And notice also, what I'm going to be focusing on today is going to be more on giving to those who are already Christians, giving within the church. This gift was for the saints. And I believe that is the priority. Before we give, general stuff that's for the world, we need to be sure that the saints, the community of God, is taken care of. So how are they to organize this? Verse 1 says, "Do it like I directed or ordered the Galatians to do." I think the NIV's translation told is a little weak. The word directed or ordered is what's used throughout the book of Acts to indicate what army officers commanded their inferiors to do. So Galatia, where is that?
I already mentioned that up here. This is in the middle of modern-day Turkey, where the first churches were that Paul planted. That's where Paul had just come from. Paul where he's currently, he's writing from Ephesus, here on the coast of Turkey. He had just come from visiting those churches on his second missionary journey, and so here he is in Ephesus, and he's writing the book of 1 Corinthians. How did the Galatians do it? Verse 2 tells us. They were to make regular deposits into a treasury that was with them. Translations you may have, lay by him in store, or lay, or put something aside, storing up, or set aside a sum, saving. NIV got some alliteration going there. The present tense of this verb, lay aside or make deposits, put aside, is in the present tense. The present tense command in Greek indicates continuing action. It indicates a habitual, repeated thing, not just one gift, but make this a repeated thing. If he only meant to give it once, he would have used the aorist tense instead of the present tense. But it's present tense here. Continue. Make it a habit to give, to put money aside. Each contributor was to literally lay his money next to him. This led has led some Bible scholars to consider that this was done at home. Chrysostom, one of the who was a famous pastor about 200 years after Paul, exhorted his congregation in ancient times to make your house a treasury for the Lord. That's a great exhortation. Do you have a treasury system for God in your house? Do you have a household budget where there is a line for giving money to the Lord? Or maybe you use a cash system. Probably more kids are more likely to be doing that with some sort of a cash system. Do you put offering money in a separate container and bring it to church? When our boys were younger, that's what we would do. We gave them one of those little rubber change purses that opens when you squeeze it. And so throughout the week, when they made income for whatever it was for chore money or mowing the lawn or something, you know, we'd help them calculate what a tithe was and put that in the change purse and make sure that those change purses make it to church. And sometimes embarrassing, they're shaking the coin out into the offering plate. But I think that's a good practice. Most commentators I read believe that this word treasuring or storing up or saving indicates not stuffing it on your mattress at home, but rather depositing it into a church treasury. The treasury would be a lot like the little treasure box that we have on the back corner of the literature table there. If it were just to be saved up at home, then Paul would have exhorted them to put the money away, not on the first Sunday, the first day of the week, but on Friday, payday, right? It would also, if the money was all being stored in people's homes, then there would have to be some kind of a collection when he got there anyway from everybody's homes. And he said he doesn't want that. So I think probably that throughout the week they were to lay it aside, and then on the first day of the week put it into the church treasury. That makes the most sense to me in terms of kind of how this was administrated. And this brings us to the timing of these gifts. It was to be on the first of the week. I've heard a lot of criticism from the, I guess, Seventh-day Adventists. I grew up I went to college and church in Chattanooga. And one of the things that we would do outreaches on Sunday morning during the Sunday school hour. Me and some of my college buddies would go out and do evangelism in the flea market.
And the people we find there were all either backslidden Baptists or they were Seventh-day Adventists who didn't worship on Sunday morning, so they were out there. The criticism against Christians who are worshiping on Sunday is something worth considering. Why, if God said worship on Saturday, the seventh day of the week, why are Christians violating God's law by making Sunday our Sabbath? The word here for week is if you pronounce the Greek word, it would sound like Sabbath. That word by itself is sometimes used to indicate that a certain day, seventh day of the week. It's also used throughout the Bible to indicate an entire week, a group of 7 days. But in the New Testament, this new phrase emerges, the first of the Sabbath, the first of the week. And I believe this indicates a new Sabbath for Christians on the first day of the week, rather than the seventh day of the week, Saturday. The first day of the week had significance throughout the Bible. It was the day God created the heavens and the earth, as well as light. Genesis 1:1. It was a day of fulfillment in the Old Testament holidays. I mentioned before the first fruits ceremony, where they were to bring the first produce of their fields and wave it before the Lord as a gift to God, and kind of in promise of the harvest that was to come. That was done on the first day of the week, not on a Saturday. Then there was Pentecost, or the Feast of Weeks, typical of the fruits of the resurrection of the Christian church, which had a holy convocation on Sunday, the first day of the week. The Feast of Tabernacles, likewise, ended with a holy convocation on Sunday, the first day of the week, which the Feast of Tabernacles or Sukkoth of Booths could be considered to be a picture of the ingathering that was a harvest feast, typical of the fruits of the resurrection, the gathering of all God's saints in the end times. What else happened on the first day of the week? Jesus rose from the grave on the first day of the week, making that the day of a new creation. And that day came to be called the Lord's Day. We see John using that phrase, the Lord's Day, in the book of Revelation. And it has become a church tradition since then to call the first day of the week the Lord's Day, Sunday. And the first day became a day that the early church met together for worship. We read in Acts chapter 20, verse 7, upon the first day of the week, when we were gathered together to break bread, Paul taught. The first day of the week was the day that they gathered together to share a meal, to take communion, and for Christian teaching. It was apparently their habit to meet on the first day of the week. The fact that they were to make their deposits on this first day of the week indicates that it was the business of the church and part of the worship of God. Giving tithes and offerings is and should be part of what we do on Sundays. It's part of the worship of God. If we're not doing this, something is wrong. Notice also who was to give. Was it just the wealthy or those with some special spiritual gift of giving? No. He said it's for all of us. Each one should lay aside. How much then? Each one should lay aside as, and we have different translations here, as he has been profited. There's some variation in how much we give. The Greek word here is euhados, which those of you familiar with that, eu means good, and hados means road. So the picture is they've been out on a business trip and they had a good return and came back with money in their pocket from their business trip. And this hints at the concept of a tithe. Each one should lay aside as he has been profited. Chrysostom commented on this passage, we should give no less than 10% of honest income. And I thought it was kind of funny. He said, now, if you're a banker and you charge usury, don't bother bringing that to church, because that's dishonest income. And he said, if you're a soldier, don't bring your income to church either. That's dishonest income. But certainly anything that we got dishonestly, stole, that's not income that should be given to God. That is money that should be restored because it was taken wrongfully. It's possible to be a banker or a soldier and not be stealing. So, it's true that there's no specific percentage of income given to us in the New Testament. How much should we give? If it should be as God has prospered us, then how much should that be? Give me a number. We like numbers sometimes because it makes us not have to grapple with thinking through it or grapple with actually being generous. I believe that God, well, there's no question. God gave specific instructions about how much to give, at least at a base level, in the Old Testament. He commanded to give 10% of your increase, not 10% of not 10% of your growth, because some of that, whatever you make gross, has got to be paid back for your business expenses that were incurred in making that money. But your net profit should be 10% given to the Lord. On top of that, there were many, many more opportunities for giving to the poor, such as not harvesting to the edges of your fields, not getting the maximum amount that you can out of your business, but leaving stuff that other people who are poor can take advantage of, purposely leaving stuff in your business that other people can take advantage of, as well as, you know, lending to the poor without usury, and I would say that's without without interest, but I'm not going to get into that today. Many more things, in addition to that 10%, many more opportunities to give. So it was not merely 10% even in the Old Testament. In the New Testament, Jesus commended the Pharisees for tithing. In Matthew 23, he said, you tithe mint and dill and cumin, and this you should do. He didn't say, oh, that's Old Testament law, we're going to do something different now. He said, no, you did the right thing, but you neglected these weightier matters, justice, compassion, love. Do the 10%, but go over that. Another thing we learned from this passage is that our income is not just something we earn, but it's rather something God provides for us. The Greek verb here, for as he has been profited, is in the passive voice. So it's not, literally, it's not according to what he did for himself, but passively, according to what he was profited. There's a subtle difference here. I hope I'm not making too much of it, but it's important to recognize that our money is God's provision to us, not some reward that we, of our own sufficiency, earn for ourselves and have the right to do whatever we want with. And the King James actually adds the word God in order to emphasize this point. Even though it's not in the Greek text, King James says, as God has prospered him. And I think that is the sense, even though they added a word. And that's why we give. It's to recognize King Jesus as our provider and give him our tribute, recognizing that all we have is a gracious gift from him. Note also that there's some recognition in verse 2 that some people might not have profited. Would God demand us to give if he hadn't given us any money to give? No. There's no profit, there's nothing to tithe on. Although, you know, even so, we can still give if we want to, but it's there's no legalistic command that you have to give something if God hasn't provided anything for you to give. So there's no one number that I can, you know, that anybody can throw out at you and say, well, you have to do this. It's something that you're going to have to wrestle through. The only landmark we have is this 10%. We should not measure ourselves. Let's see. Here, 2 Corinthians 8 also mentioned this concept, 8:12. If the readiness is there, it's acceptable according to what a man has, not according to what a man does not have. If you want to give, but you don't have any money, then it's okay, he said. 2 Corinthians 9:7, he should give as he has purposed in his heart. There is a thought process. Make a decision, purpose in your heart, you know, as you prayed about it and got guidance from the Holy Spirit, and you've made your plan, execute that plan as you purposed in your heart to do. Here's another measuring stick besides the 10% rule. And the measuring stick is not what other people do, it's what Jesus did. In 2 Corinthians chapter 8, Paul said that these people should make their decision about how much they give based on Jesus' example. He said, you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, that through his poverty you might become rich. And that's kind of how he concludes his argument of encouraging the Corinthian church to give, is pointing them to the example of Christ. And that's what we should always do. So we can summarize this verse by saying that our giving should be systematic. It should be proportionate to our profits. And it should be voluntary. Then verse 3 tells us about the administration of the gift. Who should administrate it? Verse 3 highlights the need for integrity and wise administration regarding church finances. There's a difference if you've got a King James text versus a more modern text. The King James follows the exact word order in the Greek, putting the phrase by letters immediately after the word approved or accredited, indicating that Paul was asking the Corinthian church to approve by writing letters who would administrate the gift. However, most commentators seem to prefer the approach that the NIV and the New American Standard use, saying that these were letters of introduction that Paul would write, not the church writing. Letters of introduction to explain the gift, why it was being given, who was for, and all that. And introducing maybe the men that were carrying the gift and all that. That same word is used later on in 2 Corinthians 3 in the same context of writing a letter of recommendation. Whichever way you take it, it was the people in the church who were to approve who administrated the gift. Men handling church funds were to be elected, tried, and approved. We see in Acts chapter 20, verse 4, the names of some of these men from the different churches who were approved for carrying the gift from their church. From the town of Berea, we have... Oh, where's Berea? Over here. Sopater was chosen to administrate the giving from there. From the church in Thessalonica, here, Aristarchus and Secundus were chosen. From the church in Derbe, over here, back in Galatia, who's named there? Gaius. And then the church in Ephesus, Tychicus and Trophimus were chosen. So we actually have the names of these administrators that were chosen by their church to handle the funds for this trip to Jerusalem. And then in 2 Corinthians 8, it mentions three people appointed by the church in Corinth later on. Only one of them is actually named in that passage, Titus. I think probably the same Titus that the book of Titus is from. is written to. Paul then goes on to explain in 2 Corinthians 8:20 why he had these church representatives involved. He said, I want to avoid that any man should blame us in the matter of this gift, which is ministered by us. For we are thinking of what is honorable, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. He's choosing these trusted administrators in order to do not only what's right in the sight of God, but to be above reproach with people as well. And that's just applying it to our church. We don't have just anybody handling church money. In our local church, we have a qualified accountant, Mark Lindell, who handles them. And he has a system of accountability. When he opens that box and counts the money, he pulls somebody out over to count it with him and sign the form with him. So, you know, if he calls you after church to help sign it, take that responsibility seriously. It's intended to be a real accountability. So do it. Hold them accountable. Mark also provides regular reports on the church finances to the steering committee. So if you want to hear his next report, I think it'll be this Friday morning at Chip's office. When we have enough members and elders, we'll probably go add a congregational component where a budget will be presented to the congregation for approval, as well as an annual report of the church income and expenses. And also, you've got on the table your 2009 giving report. This is another step of accountability. If there's funds unaccounted for and you know you gave more than what's on there, then you can say, hey, something's wrong here, and we can trace it down. Church giving needs to be done in an accountable fashion. The passage then ends with verse 4, where Paul discusses the possibility of himself going along with the others to deliver the money. Most English translations translate verse 4, if it is fitting or if it's advisable for me to go, I'll go. Most of the commentaries I read on this implied that Paul would accompany the gift only if there were sufficiently large funds to do it. The word literally means weighty, if it's heavy enough. And I wonder if part of the consideration here was that the people chosen to carry the money to Jerusalem had to have their traveling expenses paid in some way, so they may have been authorized to use some of the funds that they were carrying to pay for their own journey to get there and deliver what was left. So maybe if there wasn't enough money to cover, you know, more people going along, then maybe it wouldn't be a good idea for Paul to be using up the church money just to travel to Jerusalem without really there being, and you know, there are no funds left over when they get to Jerusalem. But note that Paul is not just raising money. He's recruiting people. So we have representatives from 5 churches all converging in Jerusalem. What an encouragement that would be to the Christians in Jerusalem. And here they're all, you know, people with apparently the time on their hands to help with things. Perhaps they were able to contribute to other things, as we see with Titus, who was sent from Corinth, ended up going back to, if I remember correctly, it was Crete, to organize churches there. He was able to serve long term. Giving people, not just money, is important. So how are some ways to apply all this information? I think this is the first time I've done a sermon on money here. There's a lot of things that we've thought through as a steering committee as we've organized things, and I think it's good to tell you about that and explain some of the ways that money is used in our church. One of the ways that money is used is to support the administrative functions as well as the teaching ministries and the pastoral ministries of the church. this is supported by what Paul wrote Timothy in First Timothy chapter 5 verse 17, that the elders that rule well, there's administration, be counted worthy of double honor, and he's speaking specifically of money there, especially those who labor in the word and teaching. There's the teaching aspect of ministry. These things are part of the organization and ministry of a church, and they're deserving of financial support. In our church, we also have committed to support some local mercy ministries and purposefully have ways that we provide help to the poor. We're giving regular monthly gifts to Life Choice Ministries and Shepherd's Crossing out of our church general budget. As a result, and understanding these things, there are good reasons for putting money into the church treasury, because it is used for helping the poor and supporting the administrative and teaching and pastoral ministries of the church. Missionaries are also supported by our general fund. We have four missionary families that we give monthly support to. We're also supporting missionaries by giving them care packages. We're just starting this up next month, hoping to send the first care packages to some of our missionaries. Be generous in thinking about what you could contribute to a care package for our missionaries. And talk with Danya Schmigge about that. Mercy requests. Just this week, or just a couple days ago, I got a phone call from yet another person saying, I need help financially. I'm not part of any church. He's obviously calling through the phone book. How do we handle that thing? We're trying to respond to those kinds of requests in a relational way, meeting with them personally, inviting them into the community of our church. Often that's not what they, well, so far never has been, has that been what they want. What they want is just a quick buck. But that's what we want to keep our doors open for that possibility. The scriptures tell us he who despises the cry of the needy is despising God. And we don't want to do that. So, we need people who are willing to respond to these kinds of things, and I can't respond to all of them. But if any of you are interested in being part of that response team that would go and sit down at the coffee shop or over lunch or something and just talk with some of these people that call the church asking for money, and then begin understanding their needs, begin understanding how we can minister to them, and financial support is part of that. As well as the support of friends that will hold them accountable and other factors helping them find work. Mercy ministry to the poor. Spontaneous giving is another thing. When the Matthews went to the hospital, when was that, 2 weeks ago? Spontaneously, people were organizing meals and delivering meals to them. That's great. Those kinds of things often don't get praised in the pulpit. A lot of the little things that we do for each other are never going to be, you're never going to get much affirmation for that. But God says, Jesus said, even giving a cup of cold water in my name to somebody, you will not lose your reward for that. Be on the lookout for the little things you can do. That goes for kids as well as adults. Be on the lookout for things you can do to help others. We're seeing in the news all this information about the earthquake in Haiti. Appeals for money to be sent over there. Last year our church contributed to a one-time special gift to friend of someone in our congregation who was doing ministry there in Iowa, so we gave some flood relief money to that person. Money given in times of disaster can easily be misdirected. I remember the 20 years ago, all the rock stars that got together raising millions of dollars for Ethiopia, and how much of that money just went into the pockets of the warlords and didn't really get to the poor. Careful research has got to accompany anything that we do when we're giving to the poor. We shouldn't just give willy-nilly. We do need to do our homework. But good research should reveal who's worth giving to. Sending people to needy parts of the world to do relief and Bible teaching is important. I know this year we've got Rachel Schmigge planning to go to Ireland. Now let's support her. Chip Zachary is considering going to Kenya. Let's support him and his family in that. I heard that the Porters are thinking of developing some kind of a mission trip. Let's support them in that. Megan is heading to Eastern Europe. I haven't heard which country she's settled on. Let's support her in that. We can send our own people, just like the ancient churches did. Send our own people. Looking beyond just this year, how many of you are willing to give your own children as missionaries long term, or to go yourself long term as a missionary? I'm hearing interest on Melissa's part and going overseas for a longer period of time. It's tremendous. Giving your best to the master involves giving your sons to bear the message glorious, giving your wealth to speed them on their way, and giving your time, pouring out your soul for them in prayer victorious, to quote the words from the hymn, O Zion Haste. If we realized how great a blessing it is to give, we'd be beating down the doors of opportunity. God said through Malachi, if his people would tithe, he would open up the windows of heaven and pour out such a blessing on them that they would not have room enough to receive it. Do you believe that if you tithe, God would give you that kind of blessing that you couldn't even hold that much money? Wow. Jesus said it's more blessed to give than to receive. Do you believe that? Paul promised the Corinthians here, in 2 Corinthians 9, as a result of their giving, they would be enriched with everything for doing all of God's will. Paul also told the Philippians that their donations to him were giving more blessings to them than the donations were giving to Paul. He said, when you give to me, I'm just seeking your blessing from all that, even though he's the one receiving the money. Do you realize how rich the rewards are that God promises to those who give? Let's take every opportunity that God gives us to set aside money for his work. As you have been prospered, and administrate it wisely through those that the church approves, so that our giving may be used to spread God's kingdom, bring relief to the poor, and glorify God.